Hello and welcome to the Journal of Zoology podcast. I'm Anne Brawe. In this episode, I talk to the authors publishing in the journal in July, August and September. We learn about the feeding habits of the reintroduced Eurasian beaver, possible reasons why the giraffe has evolved such a long neck, and the amazing attachment ability of Colorado potato beetles. Lastly, I talk to reviews editor Stephen Lacomba about the new online archive of the previous titles of Journal of Zoology. The European or Eurasian beaver, Castor fiber, was once widespread across Europe and Asia. However, during the 19th century, overhunting eliminated the beaver across most of its range. Today, through reintroduction and regulation of hunting, their numbers have recovered in many European countries. Being a potential keystone species, the beaver has far-reaching effects on the structure of its ecological community, not only through directly changing its environment by constructing dams, but also by foraging for food. To find out more about the feeding habits of beavers and the possible impacts of reintroducing foraging beavers, I spoke to Jarmila Krajerova from the Institute of Vertebrate Biology at the Academy of Sciences of the Czech Republic.
Hello, Anne.
Hi, Jarmila. So why is it important to assess the composition of beavers' diets?
Yeah, good question. The Eurasian beaver was originally distributed across the whole of Eurasia. However, during the 19th century, most beaver populations were decimated. Subsequent protection and numerous reintroductions during last century have helped the beaver to recover throughout much of its former range. Reintroduced populations now exist in many European countries and are gradually expanding. Unfortunately, beaver reoccurrence is the reason for the increasing number of conflicts between beaver conservation and forestry management, river authorities, pond fisheries or agriculture. Therefore, it is important to study feeding ecology of beavers and to assess their diet composition. We think only detailed knowledge of their food habits can help to make correct decisions and to set similar conflicts.
So as you mentioned, there is currently a lack of detailed knowledge on beavers' feeding ecology. Why is it difficult to research the feeding ecology of beavers, and how did you overcome this in your study?
Research on the feeding ecology of beavers is difficult for several reasons. The Eurasian beaver belongs to species with predominantly nocturnal activity, so it is difficult to observe the individual directly. In comparison with other herbivore species, it is also difficult to use indirect methods for studying beaver's diet. The monitoring of gnawing on woody and occasionally also on non-woody plants was used for studying feeding ecology of beavers. However, this method is suitable for qualitative, but not for quantitative assessment of the dietary composition. The proportion of particular food resources in the diet of mammals, herbivores, as well as carnivores is preferably assessed using two indirect methods, analysis of feces and analysis of their stomach content. Eurasian beavers do not belong to game species. They are not regularly hunted. On the contrary, they belong to species which are protected in many European countries, including the Czech Republic, and thus it is almost impossible to obtain their stomachs for the analysis. Analysis of feces, which is widely used for studying diet composition of many other herbivore species, especially ungulates, also cannot be easily used for the beaver because it defecates directly into water. Mm-hmm. Therefore, it is impossible to find their dung. Fortunately, we had a unique opportunity to use this method thanks to the long-time project of Dr. Aleš Vorel from the Czech University of Life Sciences in Prague. This project is focused on beavers' ecology and its spatial activity, and one part of the research is also telemetry observation of beavers, thus they have to be caught. Catching makes it possible to take various samples from beavers, for example, blood for biochemical or genetic analysis, and among other things, also the feces. Fecal samples were taken by palpating the rectum of the individual. During 5 years, we were able to collect 97 samples from 4 study sites which were long distance from each other and represented different habitat types.
How did you analyze the components of the beaver's diet?
So we used a method of microhistological analysis of feces, which is frequently used for studying herbivore diet. Mm-hmm. It is a time-consuming method and requires a lot of patience and a long-time experience, which we gained during several years of study of deer diet composition. However, analysis of beaver feces was slightly different, and we had to modify this method to make it more suitable for the beaver. Plant fragments of different size remain in beaver feces, from very small ones up to several centimeters. Also, the whole fecal sample was much bigger than one deer pellet, which is usually used for analyzing deer diet. So it was impossible to identify all plant remains in the sample. Therefore, we decided to use several sieves to separate the sample to three parts: microfraction with fragments smaller than 1 millimeter, macrofraction with fragments bigger than 3 millimeters, and a part of the sample with fragments between these two levels which wasn't analyzed. Macrofraction was analyzed using a binocular, and microfraction was used to prepare a glycerin slide, which was analyzed under microscope. We used specific structures like stomata or trichomes, which remain on plant tissues even after their passage through the digestive tract of the beaver, to classify the remains to the family genus or species level. However, a part of the fragments could not be classified to these levels, so we had to use also other categories like deciduous trees, forbs, grasses, or fruits, and so on. These categories are usually used in food analysis of herbivores.
That sounds very meticulous. And so what did you find out about what the beavers were eating, and did this differ considerably across the seasons or the different study sites?
We studied beavers' diet composition from spring to autumn, so only during vegetation season, when beavers were caught. Beavers captured during the winter might suffer when held in the trap, so we avoided winter trapping. Generally, beavers consume mostly deciduous trees and various species of forbs. Consumption of grasses, aquatic plants, field crops or fruits was negligible. Deciduous trees were dominant in spring samples, regardless of the study site, and they formed from 80% to 100% of the diet. During summer and autumn, proportion of deciduous trees decreased, and the proportion of forbs significantly increased at all study sites, even though forbs dominated over deciduous trees only at one site. However, the amount of deciduous trees and forbs significantly varied among samples, and not only between study sites but also within a particular site. Therefore, we tested the influence of habitat structure on the dietary composition as one of the possible factors that could affect the ratio of deciduous trees and forbs in the diet.
So what effect did different habitat structure have on the dietary composition of the beavers?
We mapped several variables in beaver territories, for example, cover of shrub and canopy layer, and the number of species in these layers, and so on. And we then tested effect of all these variables on the volume of the deciduous trees in beaver diet. The results showed that the amount of the deciduous trees in the diet was influenced by the structure of riparian stands. The volume of the deciduous trees in the diet was higher in samples from territories with higher coverage and diversification of the shrub layer. The proportion of forbs in the summer diet of beavers seems to be higher in areas with lower cover of riparian stands, or in areas with uniform stands, or in areas with stands formed by non-palatable woody species, for example, spruce or alder.
I know that one of the worries about reintroducing the beaver was the impact of beaver foraging activity on economically important plants. Did you find any evidence of beavers foraging destructively?
Based on our result, we assume that beavers preferably consume economically unimportant tree species, for example, willow, birch, or dogwood growing near the riverbank. We detected no economically important tree species in the diet, like, for example, oaks, which are frequently planted in plantlet forests in the Czech Republic. As for field crops, we found only the remains of maize, and these were found only in 5 fecal samples. This result indicates that beavers do not cause high levels of damage to economically important trees or field crops during vegetation season.
And do you have any plans for future research into the feeding ecology of the beaver?
Even though the research of feeding ecology of the beaver in the Czech Republic is still running, the part focused on the diet composition is finished, at least for now. However, we talked with Dr. Aleš Borel about the possibilities to study food interaction of the beaver with other herbivore species like red deer or roe deer in the flat plain forest habitat. So we will see what the future brings.
Jarmila and colleagues have shown that there is a high degree of ecological plasticity in the beaver's diet and no evidence that they cause high levels of damage to commercial forestry and agricultural practice. You can read the full study, Feeding Habits of Reintroduced Eurasian Beaver, Spatial and Seasonal Variation in the Use of Food Resources, in the July issue. So how did the giraffe get its long neck? While this may sound like the title of a Rudyard Kipling Just So story, the evolution of the giraffe's neck is still one of the most highly debated questions in zoology. Standing at around 5 meters, with half of that height made up of neck, the giraffe is the tallest land animal alive today. Rob Simmons and Rez Altweg had another look at the evolution of the giraffe's neck in a paper published in the September Journal of Zoology, and Rob was kind enough to agree to talk more about the evolutionary history of the giraffe.
The elongation happened relatively suddenly, sometime in the mid to late Miocene, so I understand. I'm not a paleontologist. And we did start off from fairly small okapi-like animals. So we're talking about an animal that's about, let's say, 6 foot at the shoulder when adult, completely grown. And those were actually in India and migrated into Europe and then down into Africa approximately 7 million years ago. And it was then that the fast radiation took place into very large, tall, giraffe-like animals that we see on the African plains today. So it was a relatively rapid process from about 7 million years ago. And we saw a giraffe, we didn't see it, our ancestors saw it on the African plains about 1 million years ago. What they saw and what we see today are very, very similar.
So what are the main hypotheses put forward to explain the evolution of the giraffe's long neck?
Well, I think they can fairly easily be divided into two, one of natural selection or natural selective origin and one of sexual selection. Mm-hmm. The natural selection has been called the competing browsers hypothesis, and it was actually first proposed by Darwin in his 1871 book. And basically that says through competition with other browsers, the giraffe has increased its height to avoid further competition with those other browsers, and particularly during times of dearth. So the dry winter seasons that we have in Africa, there'll be very few leaves on trees, and if you're a tall giraffe, you should be able to get those last remaining leaves on your favorite acacia trees, whereas your smaller competitors will not be able to. Those that, of course, are taller will pass on those genes. They will survive, pass on those genes to their offspring, and therefore you should have a taller giraffe in a few million years or so.
And the sexual selection hypothesis?
The sexual selection hypothesis, I didn't rename it, but it was dubbed the Necks for Sex hypothesis by a guy called Senter, who is looking at dinosaurs and the very long necks they have. That basically posits that the long neck is used in combat by males. And if a male has a long and a strong neck, he should be able to beat any rivals for access to estrus females. So unlike any other animal on earth, a giraffe is actually fighting using its head as a club. And the power for that club is, of course, the neck. And so you have a long and a strong neck. They're about 2 meters long, the necks, and the heads can weigh up to 30 kgs. So you can imagine, you know, a carbon fiber pole, if you like, is the best analogy probably, of 2 meters with a 30 kilogram bludgeoning end to it, smashed with as much force as it can into an opponent. And that is what is doing the damage and is winning the battles for these estrus females. And we know actually from other work that estrus females actually prefer the males with the longer necks, but we'll get on to that just now. To summarize here, there's a natural selection hypothesis and there's a sexual selection hypothesis.
So when you are looking at these two hypotheses, how would you go about teasing apart which one might actually be responsible for elongating the giraffe's neck? I mean, assuming these hypotheses are, in fact, mutually exclusive.
Those who propose hypotheses always like to see their hypothesis as the main and only one. And as Charles Darwin said all those years ago, it's very unlikely that one single hypothesis would ever explain the morphology or the behavior or other traits in any animal. So I think we're slowly coming around to the idea that probably both hypotheses, the sexual selection and natural selection, have played a role at some time in the past. And what we're doing, of course, now, Anne, is to look at what is happening in extant animals which are around today. And so we mustn't ever forget that these animals weren't always this size, that there would be lots of selection pressures we don't see, you know, drying periods, for example, periods of more rainfall, more competitors, larger competitors, and so on, which, of course, we're not seeing today. So there's a past component and there's a present-day component.
So, thinking about the competing browser hypothesis, what evidence could we look for in present day that would support this?
If we look at present day and we're looking for support for the competing browsers hypothesis, we would look for, are animals actually at some advantage by feeding off very tall trees? Mm-hmm. Now, in East Africa, the answer to that question is actually probably not, which is why we questioned it in the first place. We've got a lot of animals, especially the females, which are feeding off low bushes. And in the times of winter, when Darwin himself said you would expect to see the greatest selective pressure, and competition for food, these animals are actually going to the low gruyere bushes out on the plains, and they're not going to the taller trees. That's in East Africa.
Right.
In South Africa, some very nice work done by my friend and colleague Jan du Toit and Elissa Cameron have shown that actually in Southern Africa, the animals in those winter dry periods are going into the dry riverbeds, and they are gaining an advantage by feeding off the tall trees, which still have their small and succulent leaves.
Mm.
So that is good evidence for the competing browsers hypothesis. They also did a very lovely experiment where they did some exposure experiments. They built platforms around trees to stop giraffe from browsing on the trees, near the Kruger Park, where their original work was done. And they had found that the giraffe were feeding faster off higher parts of the trees in the Kruger. So the question was, are they giraffe feeding there because the trees are putting more resources into the higher parts of the canopy, or because competition is pushing the giraffe there to forage more successfully and faster there? So by putting the exposures around, they stopped the giraffe feeding there, and they found it wasn't the trees were putting more resources into those leaves in the higher part of the canopy. It was actually the browsers in the lower parts of the tree, up to about 2.5 meters, were actually taking so much forage that it was actually to the advantage of a giraffe to go higher than that, to go above 2.5 meters, because there was more forage left. So in other words, the giraffe really were out-competing. By going above their fellow browsers, they were out-competing them, and you could see a very positive advantage to having a long neck. What I would like to see, and I will knock their experiment at all, is to see that repeated in East Africa, because that's where most of the data on the low foraging and even during the winter periods seems to be coming from. So it seems to be a dichotomy, a difference between East Africa and South Africa. It'd be very nice if their experiments could be repeated in East Africa.
So it's very interesting that there is this difference in the feeding behavior of giraffes in South and East Africa, suggesting that there may be more to this issue than just the one hypothesis. You mentioned the sexual selection hypothesis. So what lines of evidence support this hypothesis?
Well, we unfortunately have no experimental evidence per se, like the competing browsers. What we're looking for is morphological differences, and we are looking for behavioral differences. So the first thing we did was to ask, what are the traits common in sexually selected morphological traits? And one of the things that's popped out of the literature is that they are generally positively allometric, which basically means that as the trait grows, in this case the neck length, it should grow faster than predicted by body mass alone. So I don't want to get too mathematical because I'm not a mathematician. If you say Mathematically, you can say that if the exponent of the trait in question is higher than 1.0 relative to body size, then it's positively allometric.
Right.
If the exponent equals 1, then it's called isometric. So if we, for example, had a mass that continued growing at the same rate as the body mass, then it would be isometric. What happens in sexually selected traits is that's generally positively allometric. So we expect it to be above 1, and if it's isometric, we expect it to equal 1.
Mm-hmm.
When we looked at some rather bizarre data that came from Namibia, and I say bizarre because they were culling giraffe for other reasons in Etosha National Park in north central Namibia. My colleague, Lou Skippers, he measured and weighed all of these necks. And he found when we plotted them that the male necks were actually growing faster than one would predict just based on body mass. If you looked at then the females, they were actually isometric. So those exponents I was talking about for the males would be 1.34, or was 1.34 in our sample of over 70 giraffe, and for the females it was 0.9. The males showed positive allometry. In other words, it's likely to be a sexually selected trait, and for females it wasn't. It wasn't a sexually selected trait. That goes along with what we see in the wild with males fighting each other with their necks. Females don't fight at all. There might be some dominance, they might push each other, but there's no fighting being recorded in the wild. There has occasionally been in zoos.
So behavioral observations are supporting your morphological findings?
Yeah. So probably, perhaps more interesting is that behaviorally, when some researchers called Pratt and Anderson went to Tanzania, they looked for males which had large and medium and small necks, and they ranked them. So they ranked them into A, the largest, through B and C, before they'd seen any fighting. So they just ranked these males in terms of which has the largest neck and which has the smallest neck. And then they looked at all the fights that occurred in their three-year study, and they found, not surprisingly, to me anyway, that the A and the B bulls, which had the larger necks, won most of the contests, and the poor old sea animals, these were all adults, they would lose more contests than they won, and sometimes an A animal with a large neck simply had to approach a sea animal, and it would turn turtle and literally run away. And for me, one of the most interesting things is the estrus females. You and your listeners probably know that when a mammal is testing another, the female will often release a stream of urine that the male then tests in this curious phlegmon display, where he passes the he takes a little bit of urine up and he passes it over. I think it's called a Jacob's organ, might be wrong, and that way he can test to see if she is in estrus or not. So the females will release this stream of urine for the A and the B males, but they more often than not refuse to release that urine for the C males. So in other words, there seemed to be some female choice going on here as well. She preferred the A's and the B's to the C's. If a C male cannot test, he doesn't know if she's in estrus, and she wouldn't stand for him, and therefore she's exercising some choice in this whole debacle as well.
So if it's sexual selection that's mostly maintaining or driving this elongated neck, why would the females also have long necks? Is that linked back to what you were saying before, that this trait might be a neck septation and have evolved for different reasons?
I don't think that there'd be different selective pressures. I think the males are showing the elongated necks, and we mustn't forget that females of any species, males and females, there's close genetic correlation between the sexes. I mean, in humans, males have nipples and they are of no function whatsoever, and that's probably because females have them, require them for breastfeeding and so on, and there are many, many such examples like that. So what I'm saying is that I think the males and the intent selection on the neck are actually pulling the females along.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some quite nice experimental work, at least with, you know, things you can pop into a bottle in a lab, where they've researchers have selected for a trait in fruit flies, for example. Let's say it's longer wings or red eyes and so on. And it's happened with body size traits as well. If you select just in the males for red eyes, longer wings, and so on, then their progeny, the daughters, will show the same traits, even though you haven't been selecting for it in the females. And I think it's the male necks being pulling along the elongation in the female necks. And we mustn't forget that female necks are not as long as males, even for the body size of the female. They are 30 to 40 centimeters shorter, and they stop growing them. We know from our interesting data in Namibia that the females actually stop growing their necks when they are about 8 years old, whereas the males will continue putting on mass. And we know now from Mitchell and Skinner's work that it's not bone, it is actually muscle which is being put down, which is just as one might predict. And the same thing happens with the heads as well of the males. This is big-headed males we're talking about here. They actually they are depositing bone over their skull. And if you've spent any time in Kruger in South Africa or in any of the amazing East African parks, you will sometimes see these very almost grotesque males. They're large, they're often very dark, and their heads will have the two normal ossicones, those are the two little horns they're made out of bone, very tough, and they will have a projection out the front, almost like a unicorn, but not come to a point, and then they'll have two little projections out of the back as well. So some of these are called five-horned animals, and that's bone which continues to be deposited over the skull as the males, but not the females, continue to age. And of course, that appears to be for protection in these big clubbing contests that these males have.
So it seems that there's a lot of support for both hypotheses, and as you said, these two main hypotheses may not be mutually exclusive. What are the main challenges remaining for both hypotheses?
From the sexual selection point of view, we don't know if these large-necked males are actually fathering all of the youngsters that we see around. So it's very easy to do paternity tests these days, even on giraffe, and that is an MSc or a PhD waiting to happen, I think. And then this genetic correlation between the sexes. I'm not a geneticist, but I'm sure one can find out how strong it is between male and female giraffe with some fairly simple assessments, genetic assessments, DNA assessments, and so on. Because I think those are the two most important studies to be done from a sexual selection point of view. And actually teasing the two apart, the two hypotheses, I think they've both contributed to the elongated neck, but which one is the most likely, is the most prominent in pushing that neck to be, in fact, twice as long as one would predict. If you just blew up an okapi, the giraffe's neck is about twice as long as one would predict it if you just had an isometric increase.
Yeah.
But if you look in the past, there's got to be a tipping point, if you like, at which an okapi-like animal. I'm using the okapi because we all know what that looks like, and there was an ancestor that looked almost exactly the same proportions as that. It wasn't an okapi. When that animal got slightly larger, let's say to feed on taller trees to outcompete other browsers, then the neck length is going to get too long for it to head wrestle. We all know that deer head wrestle. We've seen buffalo do so and so on. If you've got a neck which is now, let's say, more than half a meter long, let's say for argument's sake, it's a meter long, it's going to be more difficult to head wrestle with a neck that long. And the appendages on the head used to look like antlers on many of these ancestral giraffes. So we knew they were head wrestling. At the point at which that neck got slightly too long to head wrestle with, one would predict, but we haven't seen it yet, we don't know, that the antlers would disappear, and you would get these smaller ossicones, as we call them, these bony growths on the top of the giraffe. You would expect them at the same time to evolve. In other words, if you're going to club somebody, you've got to have small, stout, powerful ossicones. You cannot club somebody with antlers. They would just break off. So at the same time the neck is elongating, you would expect an evolution from away from the antlers towards the small ossicones. And we haven't yet looked for that. And I think the tipping point, the turning point, could be assessed using that particular test. And again, I think that's a PhD waiting to happen. In the Journal of Zoology, you know, we have replied to critiques of our study mm-hmm. by Graham Mitchell and John Skinner et al. And we're very happy, my colleagues and I, to respond to those sort of things, because this is how science proceeds, there's no doubt. It will bring up, you know, cleverer ideas of how to test these ideas and that tipping point. Mm-hmm. You know, we all sit comfortably with our hypotheses and think we're extraordinarily clever for having come up with them. But if they're not tested, then they won't really be tested in the true sense of the word, and we will just sit and nothing will happen. Let's continue to test these. Let's ask the East Africans to go and test what the South Africans have done with their clever experiments. Mm-hmm. For the paleontologists to look for these tipping points, to look for these changes in morphology, in the neck vertebrae, in the ossicones, and so on. And I think we can probably agree at the end of the day that I don't know how long that day is going to be, but we could probably agree at the end of the day that we think we know how this long neck evolved, and that can only be done through further testing and questioning.
Thank you for taking the time to speak to us about your research.
It's a pleasure.
You can read Rob's paper, Necks for Sex or Competing Browsers, A Critique of Ideas on the Evolution of the Giraffe, in the September issue of the journal. The ability of phytophagous insects to attach to plant surfaces is actually quite remarkable. Plants do all they can to make their surfaces difficult for the insects to adhere to, with trichomes and epicuticular waxes. However, understanding the attachment abilities of insects, particularly under different environmental conditions, is important for a better understanding of a number of ecological interactions. I spoke to Dagmar Voigt of the Zoological Institute at the Christian Albrechts University of Kiel to find out more.
Insects' attachment ability is a fascinating field of research from different topics of view. For example, screenings of insect adhesive systems and their variety provide insight into the amazing evolution, and the species which show an especially strong attachment, like geckos, hunting spiders, flies or leaf beetles, they may inspire the development of novel biomimetic adhesives, for example. But the insect attachment ability is also interesting in the context of plant-insect interactions. And the attachment to plant surfaces is a crucial hurdle which insects have to overcome before they can successfully settle on their host plants. And the latter point may also provide knowledge for the field of plant protection.
Why did you choose the Colorado potato beetle for your study?
The Colorado potato beetle has been previously shown to be a suitable model organism in biomechanical studies, and we know about the detailed structures on its feet, the adhesive setae, and their functional morphology. And the males are equipped with a special male setae having a discoid terminal, and they are known to adhere particularly strong to smooth surfaces. That is why we used male potato beetle in our story. Yeah, and additionally, potato beetles are available in a sufficient number of individuals for test repetition. And at least finally, there are serious pest insects and of interest all over the world.
So they seem like a good study animal then. And how did you test the influence of moist surfaces on the attachment ability of these beetles?
Yeah, we did first observations using free-walking potato beetles on glass slides in inversion tests. And there they adhered stronger to the glass after dipping their feet in distilled water. And however, they failed walking on the water film of about 1 millimeter thickness. Our experimental setup was rather of practical interest in context of laboratory experimental setups. And beetles are frequently kept then in tubes or dishes with moist filter paper for a longer time period. And that is why in our present study we considered the influence of time that beetles stand under dry and moist conditions on their attachment ability. And therefore we put them into plastic petri dishes, which mm-hmm. were completely covered inside with filter paper. In one series, the filter paper was kept dry at 25% relative humidity, and in another series it was kept moist at 94% relative humidity. And after we put them there at different time levels, we tested the friction force using a centrifugal force device. And that was the method we used to carry out our experiments.
What did you find out about the effects of the level of moisture on the attachment ability of the beetles?
We find out that the attachment ability of beetles differed significantly depending on substrates where the beetles were kept. And the effect of different substrates depends on what level of time they present. Mm-hmm. And the beetles generated up to 2.6 higher friction forces after being kept in a moist environment compared to the dry environment. And the longer time they spent in a moist environment, the stronger was the attachment ability in the friction force test. It was the contrast finding in the dry environment. There was less attachment ability.
So the beetles with moist feet were better able to attach to the glass surfaces. But why would humidity have a positive effect on the attachment ability of the beetles?
The humidity has been found previously to be responsible for an increased adhesion of the hairy attachment in geckos. And accordingly, because beetles have also hairy attachment system, we suppose that similar phenomena may occur due to an enhanced liquid bridge formation between the terminal contacts of the adhesive seeker and the substrate. And there should be a sufficient amount of absorbed water on the surface, on the substrate, that they can build liquid bridges.
And how do your results affect the future of attachment studies in insects?
Our results shed light on the importance of the surface moisture in the attachment ability of insects in general. And moreover, the results are significant for a better understanding of plant interactions, also in the context of plant protection.
I mean, I think it's very important, as you say, because people would be doing these attachment studies and not realizing that keeping the beetles in different conditions could be affecting their results.
That is true. It is very important to know these effects to plan future experiments and experimental setups.
Thank you for taking the time to speak with us today, Dagmar.
Thank you for the questions and for the interest.
You can read the full study in the August Journal of Zoology, entitled Temporary Stay at Various Environmental Humidities Affects the Attachment Ability of Colorado Potato Beetles. The Journal of Zoology is very pleased to have recently digitized 180 years of papers from its previous titles, Proceedings of the Zoological Society of London and The Transactions of the Zoological Society of London, and these are now available online. Reviews editor Steve Lacomba and Emma Hare introduced the new online archive with their editorial, Letters on Several Subjects of Zoological Interest, and Steve joins me now to talk a little more on the impressive publication history of the journal. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Anne. Yeah, hi.
You recently paid a visit to the library of the Zoological Society of London to look at the back archives in preparation for the editorial. What did you find most interesting about this collection?
Okay, I guess the sheer scale of it. It was rather daunting, in fact. The Journal of Zoology, as you know, has its roots in several different publications, the first being the Proceedings, going back to 1830, but also its sister paper, Transactions, which merged much later. And they eventually became what is now the Journal of Zoology. So I'd rather blithely assumed I'd come down and poke around and find some interesting bits and pieces to write about, and then very quickly realised that there was so much stuff, it was going to be almost impossible. And so much good stuff. You know, there's Huxley in there and Darwin and Owen. And really it brought home to you what a small world zoology and science and biology were at that point. And it wasn't until it occurred to me really that the journal's origins were more or less contemporaneous with modern evolutionary biology in that it was first published round about the time Darwin left England on the Beagle, that it actually got some focus. And in the end, you know, to my embarrassment, I really just picked a few select issues that coincided with major events in the history of zoology, because I could still be there now. I could have spent months and months trawling through there, and it's all interesting.
So I think that is one of the good things about putting it all online. Hopefully it will be easier to search for things.
I guess that's one of the good things, but it's also going to prevent me doing any real work ever again. So that's a bit of a downside.
So in the journals that you selected, who was writing in those early issues? Were there any big names in there?
All of them. It's remarkable how many of them appear very, very quickly. I mean, Owen is in there right at the start in the very first issue. I think actually in the very second report, talking about orangutans. But Huxley is in there. Wallace is in there, being incredibly excited about finding a new species of bird of paradise. Mm. Darwin's there at a meeting talking about ground finches in the Galapagos. Everyone from the history of biology, really, is in there right from the start.
That's fantastic. And was there anything in particular which stood out about the articles of these early issues?
I think the two most striking things were first of all, stylistic and how the style of scientific writing has changed, and I'll come to that in a moment. But actually some scientific material of huge, huge interest. I think today we're accustomed to thinking that Darwin's ideas really, really struggled to gain acceptance. But that doesn't seem to have been true within the scientific community anyway at the time of publication. Mm. And that probably reflects the fact that most of the people involved would actually have been aware of Darwin's ideas many years before the publication of The Origin. As we know, he was kind of rushed into publishing that by the news that Wallace was thinking along very similar lines. But, for instance, in 1859, there's a paper by Richard Owen, again, in fact, in Proceedings, asking whether man's closest relatives are the chimpanzee and the orangutan, or the gibbons. And there seems to be an immediate acceptance that it's one of those, that we're not unique, that we do, as Huxley said, have our place in nature. The other thing that really, really jumps out is the kind of vigour and excitement that was permissible in the scientific literature back in those days. There's a piece by Alfred Russel Wallace, which I adore, because in just one sentence he has six exclamation marks in three different places in the same sentence. This again is him talking about the bird of paradise, and he says, "I cannot resist telling you, I have a new bird of paradise! Exclamation mark. Of a new genus! 2 exclamation marks. Quite unlike anything yet known, very curious and very handsome. 3 exclamation marks this time." And his excitement really, really comes across in the writing in a way that's much harder to do today. And similarly, there's a piece by Owen, which is, you know, frankly, a rather sensational account of gorillas reaching down from the canopy and plucking the locals and dropping the strangled corpses with a lifeless thud, and descriptions of the gorilla ranging from fiendish to horrible. And I can't think when the last time the Journal of Zoology would have had the word fiendish in it might have been.
Yes, most likely a very long time ago. And were there any other notable influences or reflections of major events in modern biology you picked up when you were browsing the journals?
Yeah, I think what strikes you with a modern perspective looking back at the journal's history is that when the journal was founded, zoology and, for instance, genetics — well, genetics didn't exist for a start — but zoology and even physiology were rather separate disciplines. And the change doesn't necessarily come when you might think. You know, Mendel's ideas were rediscovered around about 1900, but it's not until about 1920 that ideas of heredity and evolution really start to become more common in the journal of zoology. Mm. And similarly, of course, we've got the elucidation of the structure of DNA in the 1950s. But that doesn't have much influence on what you see in the journal until probably the 80s and 90s. And I think the difference, in fact, was PCR, the polymerase chain reaction. And at that point, genetics became cheap and simple, at least compared to what had gone earlier. And of course, as we all know now, looking at the journal, it's very common indeed to find molecular data and genetic data in there. And I think that's perhaps the single biggest change, is that zoology has become much more inclusive, which I'm sure is to the benefit of the subject.
Yeah. And I think it's going to be very interesting to see what the next 180 years will bring to the field, really.
Wouldn't you love to be around to see what's in it? Because, I guess people in 180 years' time will look back on today's journal and be just as surprised by the stylistic differences and the content.
You can access the back content, Proceedings of the Zoological Society of London, and the Transactions of the Zoological Society of London, and the Journal of Zoology from 1965, via the Journal of Zoology homepage at www.blackwellpublishing.com/JZO. Well, this brings us to the end of this episode. Thank you for listening. I hope you will join us again for the next podcast, where we will look at some of the interesting research recently published in the journal.